from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on the Forum program this morning, British author, poet, and naturalist Helen MacDonald's new book is a memoir about her father's unexpected and sudden death. It's also a detailed look at how she learned to overcome her grief by training a goshawk, a bird with a reputation as murderous, difficult to tame, sulky, fractious, and foreign. MacDonald joins us to talk about her acclaimed book, H is for Hawk, and that's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Helen MacDonald is a research scholar at the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at Cambridge and an established poet, naturalist, and illustrator. And she already has won a number of prestigious awards, including the Samuel Johnson Prize and the Costa Book of the Year for H is for Hawk. It's her book about the grief and depression following the sudden and unexpected death of a loving and beloved father, and the journey toward wholeness, as well as a central part of the journey, the training of a goshawk, one of nature's most fierce and murderous birds. Her book is also the story of the writer T.H. White, author of The Once and Future King, abused as a boy and suffering as an adult gay man who also tried to train a goshawk. And we welcome Helen MacDonald to this morning's second Forum Hour. So delighted to have you here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's great to be here.
Well, I must tell you, when Tina Larberg, one of our producers, came to me and said, Michael, you must read this book, I thought, hawks, goshawks, you know, I'm a lover of Yeats, The Falcon and the Falconer, and Ted Hughes and everything, but I really was surprised, not only by the power and the quality of your prose, but just the sheer ambition of this book and the world that you create for us. And it is a world of grief as a motivation for essentially moving forward to what you do, but it's also many books in one. I mentioned T.H. White, for example. You've got a lot of British history in here. You're doing so much and doing it really with a great deal of ambition. But let's talk first about goshawks, because when your father died, you started having dreams about hawks, and that led to the idea of getting a goshawk.
Yes, I had been a falconer for many, many years. I was this very strange child obsessed with hawks, but I hadn't done it for a while, and I was an academic historian. And then when Dad died, I just started dreaming of goshawks, and one in particular. It was an adult female bird that had knocked itself out while hunting. I think it hit a tree and was brought into this falconry center, and the staff picked her up and checked that no bones were broken. And she was this incredible bird. She was like a kind of a cross between a dinosaur and a pit bull, this muscled, strange kind of creepy animal, very, very powerful and different. And we let her go and she just disappeared into nothing. She just slipped through the air. And that was the moment I kept dreaming of. And then I thought to myself, you know, I really need to train a goshawk. And I don't recommend it as a way of dealing with grief. You know, if any listeners out there think, I know, but, you know, it was a rather idiosyncratic way of managing loss.
I think idiosyncratic is definitely the operative word here. You bought it off the internet, brought it in from Ireland and named it Mabel. But these birds, and I think listeners really need to get a picture, They're often described, of course, as wild and feral, but also as robbers and killers and psychopaths. They are fierce birds.
They have a real reputation. And certainly, you know, birders know. And if you go for a walk in kind of the woods and there's a goshawk nest nearby, they will dive bomb you and kind of hit you around the head. They're pretty scary things. But they're also just, you know, very, very mysterious. They're very hard to see. In falconry, they're renowned as being these psychopathic, almost sort of murderous, highly strung killers. And there's a bit in the book where I talk about meeting a guy once who told me that he flew goshawks. And he said, you know, if a goshawk is acting up or isn't really behaving in the ways you'd like it to, you just let it kill animals, you know, in the wild. And that will sort its head out. And I remember sort of backing away from him, you know, security. I didn't want anything to do with these animals. They seemed to me kind of a bit like Apache helicopter gunships. They were kind of brute, frightening things. But then my dad died, and suddenly they were all I could think about.
Your dad was a photographer, and it was totally unexpected. In fact, that picture, the famous picture of Diana with Prince Charles, taken by your father. Yes.
He took that, and my mum was absolutely furious with him. He went out to take this photograph at the royal wedding many, many years ago, and he stood in the same place for about 24 hours without eating or drinking or moving, and he got the picture. And then he came back and pretty much collapsed, and mum was like, "You idiot." And he said, "I got the picture." You know, and that's the real, a real kind of, you know, I guess an insight into the mind of the press photographer.
And your father and you were both identifiable to each other as watchers and as anoraks. And let's talk about anoraks for a moment.
It's such a great word, isn't it? Yeah, we were terribly, terribly sad. You know, he was obsessed with aeroplanes and I was obsessed with birds. So when I was small, we used to go for these walks. We both had binoculars around our necks and he'd look at his aeroplanes and I'd look at my birds. And we'd kind of glory in our respective sad geekdoms, you know. We were really good friends, and I think the suddenness of his passing, you know, we had no idea that he was even slightly ill. He had a massive heart attack. The suddenness was had particular effects. There was no time to prepare for it, no time to reconcile, you know, that he was not going to be there. And I became completely lost after he was gone.
And thus, Mabel came into your life. And I want to talk about that whole experience. But first, you said you had experience as a falconer, some of it over in the United Arab Emirates with Bedouins?
Yes. I worked for some years. And, my life has been very strange in some respects in that I've always either been, you know, I've got these two interests, really. And one is history and literature and poetry and writing. And the other has been birds. I'm a very keen birder and birds of prey and falconry. So after my English degree, I went off to the Gulf States and worked in conservation of falcons over there. And I met a lot of Bedouin falconers. And what was great about that is, of course, a very different culture to mine. But, you know, falconry is falconry everywhere. So we used to have these great conversations in the Majlis about, you know, there were always people sort of saying, oh, I had this bird and it was a rubbish bird. And then I started training it and it became the best bird anyone's ever known. It was like, you know, I'm the best falconer in the world. And, you know, falconers have the same conversations everywhere. It was a really interesting experience being over there. You know, this culture where falconry is still as popular, you know, amongst the general population. It's a bit like the sort of 17th century in Europe. You know, everyone does it. It's amazing.
Helen MacDonald is our guest. Her book is H is for Hawk. And Mabel, again, the reputation of goshawks is this wildness. But as she became somewhat more domesticated, I think it's safe to say you became more wild. I mean, there was a kind of trade-off, really, wasn't there?
Yes. Falconry is always talked about as this very strange negotiation between wildness and tameness. And, you know, it comes across initially, you sort of assume that you're going to be civilizing the bird. But what happens is you get a bit wild as you do so. And it's not a relationship which is to do with control, and it's not that you're kind of subjecting the bird to your will. You're just being very polite to it and giving it gifts of raw steak to get it to like you.
But despite its reputation, it can be companionable. It can be
Mabel,
cute and all
Mabel,
that.
Mabel was amazing. You know, I had this, you know, intuition that she would be this monster, but we ended up playing. You know, I'd scrunch up bits of paper into little balls and throw them to her, and she'd catch them in her beak and throw them back to me. And I remember telling my male goshawker flying friends about this, and they were pretty horrified. They said, you don't play with goshawks, you know. They have this reputation, as I say, of being kind of like feathered shotguns. But later on, I discovered that they all play with their goshawks pretty much. They just don't like to talk about it.
Falconry also has its own lexicon and its own, spate of words that, like manning and unmanned, or at least manning became associated in your mind to some extent. You had no father, you had no partner, and you became almost a kind of mind meld with this bird, really. I mean, that's what I thought of.
Yeah, it was a really, really strange experience. So the first weeks with a bird, you cut yourself off from humanity, you draw the curtains and you shrink the world to just you and the hawk. And all you're thinking about is the hawk. And because I was so lost and I didn't want to be me anymore, I ended up really sort of seeing the world through her eyes. And it became very, very strange. When I left the house with her to try and get her used to people, I remember standing there and staring at my city, which is, you know, Cambridge in England, and just not really understanding anything about it. You know, it was bizarre. There were these things that were buses and bicycles, and, you know, Mabel was sort of staring at things and I was staring too. I'd become very uncivilized as a result of that.
And also the freedom of flight. I mean, to some extent, when you're domesticating a bird that really has a natural propensity to take flight, you're navigating between a kind of wildness to escape and what I suppose we could call, and you call, the inhuman world, and trying to tame it by grief, but learning, of course, that that's not really a viable equation.
Yeah, and falconry, very deep down, is all about letting things go and hoping they'll come back to you. Every time the bird flies, it's completely free. And then you call it back, and if it comes, it comes. And every time the bird lands on your gloved fist, it becomes a sort of a miracle, really. So I was playing deep down with this notion of loss and return that I was, you know, it's all I was thinking about really with my dad.
But you're playing with fire too,
I was playing with fire. She was pretty intense. There was this one incredible time when I was flying her. She was free and she'd seen a pheasant in a hedge, and I stuck my head through trying to find this pheasant for her, and she thought my head was a pheasant, and she came down and clouted me with her taloned feet, and it was like being hit with a baseball bat, you know. And then I wandered around with blood streaming down my face, and she was trying to get to me to eat me. I mean, it was all pretty gruesome and funny as well, you know. She just it was not like hanging out with a friend. It was like hanging out with something very, very different.
Talking again with Helen MacDonald, whose book is H is for Hawk, and a book that has been much acclaimed. And as I said, as many books in one, it's about the history and art of falconry. It's about the British Empire. It's about T.H. White, too. Let's talk about him, because he was certainly a major influence here, too, wasn't he? I mean, you read his book, and the book stayed in your mind, in your craw, so to speak.
Yes, when I was very small, I read his book. I was a horribly precocious reader. You know, people used to joke, you know, joke about it. You know, that was my X-Man skill when I was small, was reading fast. And I read this book, The Goshawk, and I was really into falconry. And I didn't understand what on earth it was about. It was about a man who didn't know what he was doing. You know, why would you write a book about not something you were hopeless at? And he just, his upbringing was such, and he was such a broken man, that he didn't understand how to care for things. And he really wanted to train this goshawk and make a good job of it. But he ended up unconsciously torturing it, because he saw the bird really as himself. It was all the things he wanted to be. It was feral. He saw it as slightly gay. He saw it as full of desires that were kind of, you know,
he was
right
somewhat
there.
Sadistic too.
He was, yeah. He had sadistic impulses, which I think inevitably were a result of him being beaten almost continually when he was at school, you know. And I think he was a very difficult man, and I don't think we'd have got on if I'd ever met him. You know, he didn't think women should even vote. But I ended up finding an enormous amount of compassion for him. You know, he really, really did struggle. He really did want to be loved. And this extraordinary tragic book, The Goshawk, where he tries to train this hawk, is one of the most melancholy tragedies and the most beautiful pieces of writing I've ever come across.
You wanted to turn that into something of your own brand or your own imprimatur.
Yeah.
And there's also, they say that, I think the quote from your book, the birdwatcher's dark grail, that's the goshawk, right?
Yeah.
And looking for a goshawk, you say, was like looking for grace.
Yes. One of the strangest things about writing this book was that I kept finding myself drawn to using religious terms or spiritual language to describe certain things that it felt like or I experienced at the time. They're just aren't any secular words to really capture what it was like, you know. These birds are magical. They give you grace. They give you access to a world that really isn't human. And part of the astonishment of my time with the bird was just that, you know, it made me something that really was quite different from my previous personality. You know, I became this feral beast covered in mud and blood and thorn scratches and, you know, with tangled hair. I really turned into something very wild.
I think you used the word Neolithic. It was a
yes.
Yeah, Neolithic existence.
It was.
And yet it brought you closer and more intimately connected to something in yourself. I mean, in terms of a discovery of the wildness that was in you, the feral quality in you.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a very delicate balance between, as I say, between the wild and the tame inside yourself. I went too far with the bird. You know, what I did was, I think I'd bought into all those nature books that say when you're broken, when you're sad or grieving, if you go into the wild, into the green, it will renew you and you know, make things better. But I'd just gone way too far. And I remember going out into the, you know, every day with a hawk and watching her fly and hunt, and the whole landscape was transformed, Michael. It was like, you know, it's kind of like I was on drugs, you know. Everything was very, very complicated and beautiful and fascinating and utterly inhuman. And I just lost myself.
That was the dichotomy, the inhuman and the human. You had to read the right nature readers, though, it turned out, like Peter Matheson and Edward Abbey, to really find the compass that led you home, as you put it, or led you back.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little sample of what you've written here?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to read a bit. So this is the first moment. So I went to collect Mabel, the goshawk. As I say, I bought her on the internet. This sounds worse than it actually was. I did know the man who bred her. And we're on a Scottish quayside, and we need to check the band number on her leg against some official forms. And this is the moment where I see Mabel for the first time. Concentration, infinite caution, daylight irrigating the box. Scratching talons, another thump, and another thump. The air turned syrupy, slow, flecked with dust, the last few seconds before a battle, and with the last bow pulled free, he reached inside, and amidst a whirring, chaotic clatter of wings and feet and talons and a high-pitched twittering, and it's all happening at once, the man pulls an enormous, enormous hawk out of the box, and in a strange coincidence of world and deed, a great flood of sunlight drenches us, and everything is brilliance and fury. The hawk's wings barred and beating, the sharp fingers of her dark-tipped primaries cutting the air, her feathers raised like the scattered quills of a fretful porpentine, two enormous eyes. My heart jumped sideways.
This is the heart that had turned to salt, as you put it at one point. Yes.
Yeah, I was in a bad way that year. Yeah, I ran away from everything with this hawk. And she, you know, she was, as I say, just like White saw in the hawk everything he wanted to be. I saw the hawk as everything I wanted to be. She was boiling with life. She was utterly self-possessed. She was kind of fierce. She was full of sort of an imaginary rage, I guess, that I was feeling inside but couldn't express. So I let the hawk express these things for me.
May I say your prose is boiling with life and also, you know, has the kind of vitality to it that may indeed, I imagine writing this book also brought you out of the more inhuman or moribund state that you were in.
It was a strange process. I started writing the book properly about 5 years after it happened.
Because you read with such brio now. I mean, I read with gusto. And I know there are people who meet you and think, after reading your work, she must be really melancholy.
I do try to wear black just to sort of give people a sort of sense that I really am. No, I'm very cheerful now. And one of the weird things about writing the book was having to put myself back in the mind of the person I was then. To sort of re-experience it as I wrote it. And when I finished the book, I didn't think it was kind of grief work or therapy, but when I finished it, I felt faint. You know, it was a real goodbye to the person I'd been then and to my father as well.
Actually, I'd like to read something from your book.
Please, that would be delightful. Not feel that I'm stepping
over my boundaries here, but I was struck by this, which I think for listeners' sake seems to sum up a good deal of... Well, there's a lot in this book. As I said, it's many books in one. But you write, what I desired had come to pass, and this is a little bit of a spoilers alert here in terms of the plot of the work. I'd spent so much time with my hawk that I'd become half-hawk myself, inhuman, impervious to the loss of my father, or so I thought. But the grief, I tried so hard to hold at bay, began to bleed through. Slowly, unknowingly, I sank into a deep depression. I was so hawkish then that I didn't recognize it for what it was. Out in the fields with the hawk, everything seemed simple. But back at home, things were increasingly grim. The world became more incomprehensible, harder to hold. I struggled to rouse myself from bed, muscles and joints burning with pain. I told myself it was an allergy, that it was some kind of virus. The pain got worse. I started to believe I had some kind of terminal disease. It was hard to get up at all except to stumble outside and fly the hawk. I ignored my friends, barricaded the door, didn't answer the phone. I had made myself as wild, as strange, and as antithetical to human society as my hawk, and it had brought me to within an inch of cracking up. I couldn't go on. It didn't.
Oh, boy. You know, I really was in a bit of a strange way at that time. And I remember that there's sort of the intuitions that you have. You go, no, there's nothing wrong with me. It must be physical. I must have some, you know, it must be some kind of strange virus I have or some kind of. But no, I was just very, very depressed. And it was a very, very bad time.
It was a strange year, as you put it.
it was a very strange year.
But you came home. And that's the important thing. You began to see that maybe we're not so much like these goshawks as we are perhaps like rabbits.
Yes. And, you know, I know many people who fly goshawks, and for them, goshawks are the bit of wildness in their lives, the bit of raw inhuman wildness. But they have partners and kids and houses and jobs. And I didn't have any of those things really at the time. So all there was the hawk. And it was damaging to me. Although it was fascinating and astonishing to be with her every day and watch her fly, there wasn't enough humanity in my life. So I had to really drag myself back into the world. And I managed to do it. But it was kind of a hard job.
Well, when you talk about grief, you say grief shatters the narrative of your life. And indeed it does. But you also say that you learn that you can't tame grief. I mean, which is a pretty important piece of wisdom in itself.
You can't. And I'm looking back on it now thinking, you know, partly, I guess I wanted a goshawk because I'd read T.H. White's book many years before, and I thought deep down that, you know, if you're broken, maybe a goshawk is the answer. You know, duh, I don't think that was a good one. But I think also you can't tame grief, but you can tame hawks. And I knew I could tame a hawk, and it was a way of somehow mastering something.
It was mastery, yeah.
Yeah, mastering in myself rather than mastering the hawk. And grief is such a difficult thing, and everyone does it in their own ways. And I got very cross with the books I read after my father died. You know, I'm a historian. I always go to books to try and find answers. And they all said these are the stages of grief. And I didn't really understand quite what they were talking about.
Especially Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, yes?
Yeah. And it's an extraordinarily comforting thing to think that there are these stages you go through. But it seemed to me much more complicated than that. You know, you could experience all these different emotions in a minute, you know, in an hour. You know, it's something that you have to do your own way, I think.
And you say, looking back at that long, strange year, I see that it was my time with the hawk that taught me how to live and helped me find my way home.
Absolutely. And also made me love difference. It made me understand towards the end of that year that what was joyous about the hawk wasn't that she was like me or I was like her. It was that we shared this life, this extraordinary kind of comradeship, and yet we were utterly different from each other. And that was the joy.
And there was also the joy of learning, or the solace, really, of learning what nature can and indeed does provide. I mean, you were obviously schooled in the great poets like Wordsworth, the great nature poets and so forth. And so, in a sense, you came home that way too, didn't you?
Yeah, there's a bit of a romantic in me. And I think also writing, I'm thinking about landscape and countryside. You know, we always look at landscapes and the natural world as somehow a little bit like looking into a painting, or it's always something out there, you know, that you regard and use as a kind of mirror of your needs and a mirror of our sort of desires. And I think, you know, that actually being with the hawk taught me that nature's more complicated and beautiful and full of life and death than I'd ever imagined before. And trying to write about it, trying to get that across in prose was a marvelous thing to try and do. I mean, it was an amazing experience writing the book.
So may I ask about relationships now with hawks, with...
I have a parrot now.
You have a parrot?
Yeah, my friends tell me it's much more emotionally healthy. You know, it doesn't catch me pheasants and rabbits to eat, but it does cuddle more, and it says hello.
You have a partner, too?
No, I'm on my own at the moment, no, but that's fine. I mean, you know, these things happen.
I'm certain this book will stimulate some interest along those lines, I suspect. I mean, it really is in many ways a fascinating and remarkable book. And we're talking to Helen MacDonald, who is the author of that book. It's called H is for Hawk. The Economist said one part memoir, one part gorgeous evocation of the natural world, and one part literary meditation. And she'll be appearing at an author luncheon at Rakestraw Books in Danville at 12:30 today. And tonight at 7:30, she'll be in San Francisco at Green Apple Books on the Park. And tomorrow night, reading and signing books at 7 p.m. at Point Reyes Books. And you can join us. In fact, we welcome your involvement in this conversation. You can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, so feel free to join us with questions or comments at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us, Twitter handle @kqedforum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with author Helen MacDonald, who is the author of a book called H is for Hawk, a book which has already been acclaimed, and a book which, as we've said, tells many stories. And by the way, she'll be at Green Apple on the Park in conversation with Marie Matsuki Mockett. And again, that'll be today at lunchtime. I'm also interested in hearing from you, our listeners. I know there are many of you who may have questions or comments about the conversation we've had about her book, but I know there are a lot of birders out there. And I'm looking at an online comment from a listener who says, if your guest is ever in San Jose, California, she should go up to Alum Rock Park in the East Hills. They have a natural sciences center called the Youth Science Institute, where injured owls, hawks, and other wildlife are tended to. It's rather neat. How about the... If any of you have had some particularly worthwhile narratives that you'd like to share, and of course a cogent way, about being in the wild and particularly about birding and something that you've seen that's especially unusual or that you want to impart and talk about, I'd like to hear from you. And I'd like to also hear from some of you who may have something to say about how you deal with grief, especially that almost inconsolable grief that can go so deep into not only the psyche, but every ventricle of the heart. We do invite your involvement in the program. And again, you can join us toll free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or post any questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Let me go to callers, and we go first to Point Reyes. Cass, good morning.
Oh, good day, mate. Thank you for having me on the program. I just had a question for the doctor, if I could. My question is that I was struck really strongly by the way you described your father. He sounded very much like a goshawk because of the way you described the way he waited for his prey and then took the photo that he wanted. And so what I want to know is what kind of relationship did you have with your father? I ask this because you have this dream of a goshawk flying away, and I'm trying to get a sense of where your father fits in all this. Grief is a really wild thing, and I'm trying to understand, was your relationship with your father anything like that with the goshawk? Was it a very middle-class kind of experience?
That's a really
it's
interesting
a very
question.
Perceptive question.
Yeah, that's a very perceptive question. I'm glad I drank a lot of coffee this morning, otherwise I wouldn't have ever get my head around that. So, was he like a goshawk? Well, I think both he and I, certainly when I was young, there was a sort of sense that I learned from him that there was a way of engaging with the world that was quite a way of sort of looking at it that was quite distant. So both of us were watchers, right? We both used to sort of step back from people, I guess, and observe them from a distance. And I mean, that sounds like we were both kind of awful, really. But I mean, we both like to observe the world rather than kind of get deeply involved in things. And I think that was something that I learned from him. And I guess that's somehow tied up with my obsession with hawks, right? So there's an extraordinary line from W.H. Auden that I quote in the book. And, you know, as the hawk sees it, or the helmeted airman, this sense of wanting to keep the world at a distance and observe it, which is kind of brings a kind of safety. And I guess that although the hawk and my father, I never really saw them as the same thing, the fact that the goshawk that I dreamt about was disappearing into another world, and I kind of wanted to follow it, and that other world was where my father was. So
it was
a complicated sort of braided kind of set of things.
Well, you've already kind of intimated that you look at things through a secular eyes, but I think about, thinking about Wallace Stevens, that dividing and indifferent blue, you know, is it heaven or is there something, you know, that we can soar to or do after our life is over? It's natural, perhaps, just like you thought of biblical things, to think of that.
Yeah, and it's weird, you know, hawks, this is kind of not about my father really, but I guess, you know, hawks for millennia have been used to represent things that can cross from one world into the other, you know. And I didn't grow up in a religious family, and I don't have any strong faith myself. But certainly, these old stories about what hawks are for and what they do kind of boil underneath consciousness, really. And I think that was partly why the hawk was there. It was about crossing over to somewhere else and coming back, you know.
They're also, as is true for so many birds, identified with augury and ways of divining the future or finding out what the future holds.
Yeah, and there's a great sort of, you know, John Berger quote, you know, animals are good to think with. And you know, we think of a lot of things about the world through thinking about animals.
Again, we're talking with Helen MacDonald, and H is for Helen. H is also for Hawk. That's the title of her newest book. Let me bring some more of our callers on. Charles, join us. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Helen.
Hi, Charles.
Two-part question, and I'll throw these questions out, and I'll listen in on the radio for the answer. The lifespan of the hawk that you had, how long does she live? Is she still around? And pretty much where is she now that you have a parrot?
Okay. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, she might have eaten the parrot if she was.
Yeah, they would definitely have to be different rooms. I think that would have been a bit of a disaster. No, I flew her for a few more years in a much less intense and together manner. And then suddenly my circumstances changed and I couldn't fly her every day. And I feel really strongly that if you keep a hawk or a bird of prey, you have to let it fly every day. You can't just sort of stick it in a, you know, keep it on a perch. So I lent her to a very great friend of mine and a man who flew her every day. And then he put her in an aviary because he went off to get married. And a couple of falls ago, and she died very suddenly of a horrible fungal infection called aspergillosis. It just hit her and she just sort of keeled overnight, really, and she was dead in the morning. And we were both in pieces about it. We were both incredibly upset. She was only six, you know, which is incredibly young for a goshawk to die. They can live up to sort of 20 years. Although, in the wild, young goshawks often don't survive. I think 50% of them don't survive their first year. So she had it longer than maybe wild hawks, but she went before her time. She really did. And I still miss it a bit. I really do.
Let me thank you for the call, Charles, and go to more of your calls in just a moment. I'm also been curious about the fact that a lot of people do find something that they can laser in on and obsess about to deal or ameliorate grief or to diminish the grief, right? And you wonder, I mean, in your case, it was something very unusual and idiosyncratic, to be sure, but you wonder about that as a general method or modality for dealing with grief. Thoughts from you, maybe?
Yeah. Animals in particular seem to be an extraordinary conduit for people to move into a place where things are bearable. I have met and been humbled by so many people over the last few months, meeting them who've read the book and want to talk to me about their own experiences of grief. And very often they'll bring pictures of dogs or horses or cats. You know, these animals have kept them going in times when the human world seemed somewhere they just couldn't be in, they couldn't live in properly. And there's also been a really strange series of conversations I've had, many, many, about weird, creepy, strange events involving hawks in particular, when people have passed away, hawks flying down and landing on by the sides of graves, hawks appearing in weird places. And it's sort of made me feel that the world is a much more magical place than I assumed. It's been really quite...
Almost supernatural?
Almost supernatural. It's been very, very weird. Yeah, yeah.
Let me read a couple of emails here. Beth writes, "How I wish we had known about this book and author, for we would have jumped hoops to have her come to Angels Camp area of California to speak. We have a large falconry group here in the Sierras." So you're getting those kind of emails. And here's Shalimar, who writes, "Wow, who knew? Now I want to become a hawker since I'm already antisocial. Not a goshawk yet."
Yeah, I just want to just jump in, actually, that falconry, hawks really are astonishing animals. To be a falconer in this country it's something, you know, you've got to kind of really think about whether you've got the time, the dedication. If you have and you really, really want to get involved with these birds, then there are all sorts of very stringent examinations, and you have to be apprenticed to a master falconer. So, you know, it's not something you can kind of just, you can't go out and just buy a hawk. But it's been described as a virus to me. Someone said once you catch it, that's kind of it. And if you catch the falconry virus, it's pretty full on. So watch out, people. You know, don't get dragged into it. It can be very dangerous.
Yeah, or I don't think it can happen in a couple of easy lessons or something along those lines, like Americans often believe. I hope thinking again of Yeats, like I said earlier on, who can tell the falcon from the falconer?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And that sense that the sort of panic. I mean, one of the great things about falconry that, as I've said a little bit in my interview, is that weird joy that you get when a wild bird comes back to you. And particularly when I used to fly falcons, you have this sense that you can look up and there'll be a literal speck in the sky with drifts of cloud passing underneath it. And then you can whistle and this thing will fall like a stone, and you can hear the sort of sound of air tearing through its wings as it drops towards you. You know, nothing as astonishing as that. You know,
not much like that in nature, is there? Really?
Yeah, no, they're pretty cool, to be honest. They're
pretty
awesome. Do
you know John Cheever's novel, The Falconer?
Yes, I do. I haven't read it for a long time.
Likewise, but yeah, just came to mind. Let me bring some more callers in here, and we go to Simone. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to share that when I was 5 years old, I'm in my 60s now, my mother had a very severe nervous breakdown, and I was, looking back, I think completely blown away. It was incomprehensible to me. My mother kind of returned ghost-like. She did recover. But fortunately, we lived back to a forested area, and for the next 4 years, I spent every free moment in the woods, and I remember hours and hours studying ants and building a nest in a tree and sleeping it in my sleeping bag, identifying with the squirrels, and sleeping on the hillside and waking up with deer stepping over me early in the morning on their path. And looking back and remembering how important that was for my recovery, I've ever since felt pain for people that grow up in urban environments who suffer something traumatic and don't have nature to secure their foundation somewhere deep inside them.
Simone, that's the most beautiful. I've actually got tears in my eyes sitting in the studio. Thank you so much for that. I absolutely agree with you that you know, although I took it too far, being able to go out and be inside a world full of other minds and other lives that are not your own is the most healing, a healing distraction that there can be. It's not just a distraction, it's a grounding distraction. You know, our lives are so human, everything around us is so human. And being able to walk away from that, to walk away from language, to walk away from into something completely other it's deeply, deeply, it's the most extraordinary thing. And clearly as a child, you were very, very wise and still are.
Some reason, that perverse reason, no doubt, that line of Woody Allen's is coming into my head. I am two with nature. But you're getting a lot of almost, as I expected, advice here about why you're in the Bay Area. If you listen to my listeners, you would spend all your time.
I feel so bad about this. You know, I'm on this American book tour, and I have brought my binoculars with me. In fact, they're actually in the green room right now. I've got my binoculars in a bag, and I've just not got time to go birding. So when I'm driving around, I'm sort of my nose is pressed to the glass just in case I see something fly over. So another time, I will come back.
Well, take note, because you're getting all kinds of good recommendations. Here's Duke, who writes, Helen should check out Calaveras Road and Milpitas Sinol. I ride my bicycle out that way almost every day, and there are always a number of bird watchers out there with big cameras and binoculars. There's an eagle nest in the area as well.
Oh, fabulous.
And here's Keith, who writes, I used to sit on the cliff line on the face of Half Dome in Yosemite and watch the colony of swifts down below. Wonderful to watch them fly. One day I was there, and the swifts were flying along the cliffs when out of the blue a peregrine falcon flashed by. Not so good for one of the swifts, but mind-blowing to watch.
Yeah. I mean, watching of those falcons, which hunt, they're like, you know, if a goshawk is an Apache helicopter gunship, then peregrine falcons are like F-16s. You know, they fly birds down by sheer speed. And they just cut the world in two when you watch one fly like that. And I mean, you know, the whole day you walk around and all you're doing is replaying it in your mind. They usher in just the sublime, really, if you watch them. They're incredible things. I'm very envious of that sighting, although very sorry for the swift.
And we'll hear from another caller. Whoops, a caller disappeared. Oh, no, it's Sasha. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to share simply that I lost my dad when I was 16, and we always hiked in the hills of Marin. And now when I hike there and I live close in Mill Valley, it's really a deep, wonderful connection to him.
Yeah.
And it's almost truly like his inheritance to me. And I also feel like I'm passing that on to my own children.
Oh, that's really beautiful, that sense that a landscape is caught up and deeply entwined with your feelings for your father, and yet you can pass those on to your own children. That's just magnificent. I don't know what to say. I mean, my dad wasn't really into nature. You know, we used to laugh about this. I always burst into tears whenever I take off or land on a plane because he loved aeroplanes so much. I mean, the things that remind you of people that you loved and lost.
But make you feel that often presence of absence, yes?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. But I'm so pleased that your children will get to know this place too and have that deep emotional connection with it. It's wonderful.
And Sasha, thank you for that call. A little bit of levity for a moment. I was talking about the lexicon and the language of falconry. There's a Turkish slang word.
Yes, yarık. Okay, so this is a great, great word. So when a bird of prey is totally cued in and wants to hunt, particularly a bird of prey like a goshawk, it becomes this extraordinary, it's like it's possessed by a demon. All its feathers raise, it grips the glove, it stands very upright, it fans its tail. And this state is called in yarık. And I discovered that it's an ancient Turkish word. It doesn't just mean a hawk ready to hunt. It also means the male member in an excited state. So so there you go. You know, falconry really is a boys' game.
And, well, you've proved otherwise. Here's Darshana, who asks, if someone has excellent rapport with people, can they also have rapport with animals, or does one have to be a loner?
No. Absolutely. I think empathy, the ability to put yourself in other minds, which is part of what being a good animal person is about, is something you can learn. You can learn it with animals, but you have to use it with people too. And, you know, one of the things that when I was very small, I just used to assume that everyone was like me. I think a lot of kids do. You just assume that the world is just like you.
Well, children are narcissistic by nature.
Yeah, they are. I guess that kind of narcissism lasts quite a long time as well. I mean, certainly when I was a teenager, I used to think the world revolved around me too. But then, you know, being with animals does teach you that these things have other, you know, the world is full of minds that aren't like yours. And I think that's the key to humans too. You know, when you meet people, it's always important to realize that they might see the world very different than you do, and that's...
That's what we call empathy, when you can see through their eyes. Yeah. But seeing through animal eyes involves a whole different kind of consciousness. We had Peter Singer on recently, who you may know, who is often called the father of animal liberation. Yeah. And, you know, I was honestly thinking in reading your book about just the wildness and the inhumanity that you talk about in this Goshawk. Mm. And in some ways, of course, you know, it complements our own humanity, but in other ways, it's completely, utterly distinct from our own humanity. So when Peter Singer says things that maybe he would look at more advisedly and now in terms of phrasing, that, you know, we don't know the suffering of someone who loses a child is any greater than the suffering that chickens feel when they're cooped up all the time. And
We could never know. We could never know these things. But I just guess, you know, speciesism is speciesism, right? I mean, I kind of, you know, I'm a human and I feel more about humans than I do about animals. And the weird thing is, of course, that a goshawk, although that was the most important bird in my life and I love Mabel so much, a goshawk is pretty much a chicken with talons, right? I mean, there's nothing really different about them compared to chickens. So, yeah, the way humans interact with animals and the way we see them is always fascinating. You know, we do things to them that, you know, we discount them and we think of them in certain ways. And I think we just need to think more carefully about how we think we need to respect animals more. I personally don't think there's anything deeply immoral about hunting or eating wild animals. But I think that certain kinds of farming involving a lot of suffering are very, very morally suspect.
We would not eat a goshawk normally, though. We would eat chicken. But not goshawks.
Well, goshawks are pretty hard to catch, and I don't know if you could farm them.
Even if you could, it
there's not much meat on them either.
There's something almost...
Well, they mean more, and I mean, certainly I wouldn't want to eat a goshawk, even though, you know, they have this meaning. But those meanings have been given to them by people, right?
And here's a listener who writes, visiting the UC Davis Raptor Center a few years ago, I walked in front of a red-tailed hawk cage. The hawk was perched on the highest rope that spanned the cage. As a survivor of flying into a train, he had one wing. His eyes fixed on mine commanded my gaze, and after 10 seconds, he dove off of his 20-foot perch into the bed of gravel that lined the cage. Without any hesitation, he jumped to his talons, continued to stare me down, and conveyed, I might have one wing, but I'm still a hawk. An experience and lesson I'll never forget, the beauty of the wild and the respect that it deserves and commands.
Yeah. And what I was saying earlier, they seem made of wildness, right? I mean, they seem, and again, that sense that, you know, these encounters with birds of prey, and I hear a lot of these, like even in parks where someone will see a bird staring at them, that exchange of a look with a wild hawk can really, really be the most moving and weird experience when you encounter it.
Another caller joins us. Catherine, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I just have a couple things to say. One, I'm a spiritual support counselor for a hospice here in the North Bay, and I often have experiences of how pets and animals in the home are so sensitive to what is happening. And I often find myself spending some time, you know, comforting the animals because they kind of get a little bit pushed to the side sometimes.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. And I just think that animals know. They know what's going on. And then the other thing, I just wanted to relate quickly an experience I had with my own mother's death and hawks. And the day that my mother died, I was on the phone talking to a friend, and it was right around sunset. And I lived in the Carmel Highlands at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen a hawk in my yard. And a hawk, a beautiful, huge red-tailed hawk, flew in, landed in the oak tree right outside my window, and turned and just stared at me.
Yeah.
And I just felt, you know, the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And also I want to say that my mother was very connected to Native American tribes, especially in the Southwest. She worked in healthcare, and she was adopted by a Pueblo down there. And so so that was quite amazing. And then the hawk, after a few minutes, just flew off into the sunset. And then when we had her memorial service, which was up in the Sierra foothills, I had told this story to my siblings and family. And my nephew went outside to smoke a cigarette. He came back in and said, "Aunt Kathy, come outside." And we went outside, and above the chapel, another hawk was circling over the chapel.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just pretty amazing. And I did a little research on it after that, and apparently hawks in Native American, their religious beliefs and so forth, that they accompany the deceased or the departed.
Yeah.
It's all part of a lot of rituals and burials and so forth. Helen, do you
want to say it really is. And I mean, that's a story which is not only personally really moving, for you, but also for me, but also a story I've heard so many times, and it's very often red-tailed hawks, and it's always the same. It's really spooky to actually say this, but, you know, it's always a bird that comes to the house or comes to the yard and stands there for a while and then leaves, and then very, very often a hawk over a chapel or a place of rest afterwards. And, you know, I just don't know what to think of it. It's clearly something going on there that I just don't really understand, but which is astonishingly moving.
It's a mysteriousness. I mean, you know, you talk about watching something as close as a hawk. There's that idea of the hawks having an almost extraordinary, maybe again use that word, supernatural quality about them.
Yeah, but supernatural not in a kind of sort of, you know, magical sense, but supernatural in the sense that it's something other than what we think of as natural, you know, something which is not explainable.
Metanatural?
Yeah, metanatural. Thank you so much.
Here's Laurent, our next caller. Good morning. Is it Laurent?
Hello.
Laurent? No? Okay, we'll have to say goodbye. Craig from Sacramento, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
Welcome.
I just put down, just had to put down my 15-year-old lab.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I'm sorry too. Yeah.
That's okay. He lived a very long and hopefully happy life. But it raised a philosophical quandary for him, for me, in terms of perception of pain, and was my action truly the compassionate action? I think he mentally still would have wanted to be around, but he was clearly in pain.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether I imposed a human idea of pain and tolerance to pain that may not be transferable necessarily to a dog.
Right.
Craig, I'd like to hear what Helen has to say, but let me, as an owner of Labradors who had to put some down over the course of many years, I can tell you, and I certainly have a great deal of compassion and understand the pain and grieving of that, but when your dog is suffering, you know, it's very difficult to just allow it to continue when you know that there's going to be no abating of it at all.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And, you know, I've had very, very many dear pets I've had to do this with. And, you know, that the sort of guilt afterwards, the sense that one doesn't really understand, you know, was the animal really suffering? Would the animal really have wanted to be around? And there comes a point where you just, I don't know, at the time you know you have to do things. And afterwards, then it does feel that you might have had a choice. But I think absolutely that you did the right thing. And I'm very, very sorry for your loss.
And we thank you for the call. Again, sorry for your loss. And I believe we have Laurent this time. Laurent?
Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, I just want to say, you know, a few years back, I went through a very depressive state. It was very serious. And I was on a lot of medication and so forth. And nothing worked. And I got a dog, a little dog, which is a breed that is almost extinct. It's a Portuguese Podengo.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that although it's not a substitute for being in nature, which is sometimes not easy when you live in an urban environment.
Absolutely.
I found that the communication I have with this little dog has helped me tremendously, because it's not through words, it's through the eyes and the smell and the touch, and so close to, you know, what you can experience when you're in a forest or a field.
Well, Loren, that's well said. In fact, I think it was Harry Truman, maybe, who said, if you want a friend, get a dog. You really want a friend. But there really is that sense of getting consolation through a pet that you alluded
to
earlier.
There absolutely is. It's not what I was looking for with the goshawk, although I called her Mabel. And you know, this is kind of interesting, I guess, because Mabel comes from the Latin amabilis, meaning lovable. And even though I thought I was going to this goshawk because she'd sort of ripped me away from the human world, I guess I was still looking for love. And I have a parrot now, which is much more like a dog, and particularly also with the last caller and what you were just saying, you know, when I mean everyone goes through periods when things are hard, and you know, and if I'm having a really miserable day, my parrot will come over and just give me a massive cuddle, you know, and sort of snuggle up to me, and that means something that I think, you know, we should
helps you
discount.
Get through.
Yeah.
Seconds left, because a listener wants to know how you can get a hawk and what is the environmental impact of the hawk population.
No impact whatsoever. It's incredibly highly regulated. Get in touch with your state falconry association.
Helen McDonald,
it's
pleased
been a
to have
real
you here.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Likewise. And she'll be again at Rexroth Brooks in Danville today, author luncheon, and then go to Green Apple on the Park tomorrow in conversation, and Point Reyes reading and signing tomorrow as well. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. To all of you, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.